This is Let's Go Michigan with Jeff Sloan on 760 WJR. Your bird's eye view on Michigan's business and entertainment scene. Here's Jeff.
All right, welcome to this weekend's show. Good to have you all with us. Kristen Kajawa, Mark Pastoria here with me. I got to share a story with you. I've got a friend who, unbeknownst to me, apparently went on to The Great Voice and listened to some of our show and said, it's a really great show. You guys do a good job, bring good information. But I got to say, Sloan, you certainly are a homer. You guys really pump the state of Michigan and the city of Detroit. Is that like part of your job, or do you really believe and feel all of that? And I'll tell you, I know you guys well. You love the city of Detroit. You love the state of Michigan. I know that I do in my blood. It's not something we have to manifest or, you know, there's nothing artificial about it. We feel
very authentic.
It is authentic.
Yeah, it is.
We love our state. I said, listen, you can't have it both ways. The country doesn't get to bash Detroit all the time without us getting a chance to toot our own horn occasionally.
Right.
About some of the great things in the state of Michigan. So those of you who want to be on the bashing side, turn off the radio right now because we're about to lay it on kind of thick. We're proud of our state of Michigan, proud of the city of Detroit. How about this? Detroit's street art scene is getting national attention these days, now ranked in the USA Today's 2024 list of the 10 U.S. cities with the best street art collection. I got to tell you, street art is cool.
It's very cool.
I don't know. There's something about it. I think it says something about the culture in a given city. It says what's important, what's on our minds, what do we feel, what's culturally important, and so on. And now we've been recognized ranking ahead of New York City, Washington, D.C., Nashville, Miami, Portland, and so on. Great cities like that that have great art scenes. So we are doing well in the department of how we rank as a street art city. Love that. By the way, the rankings were determined by a panel of editors from both USA Today and 10best.com. And then the final winners are ranked by a public vote. USA Today said of Detroit's recognition, Detroit's Grand River Creative Corridor stands out as a highlight with nearly 100 murals between Rosa Parks Boulevard and Warren Avenue. There we go. They said you can ride the Detroit People Mover on its 2.9-mile loop, take in the art scene.
It's fun. Even when you're downtown, like at Eastern Market, there's art everywhere.
Yeah.
It's so fun. It's fun to take pictures in front of. It's fun to do a little I Spy with your family. It's cool.
Mark, you're an artiste. You happen to be on the music side of things, but you know what it means to have a city that's got a rich culture of art, whether that be music, whether that be painting, whatever it may be. It's really important, isn't it? And it really says something about the people that live there.
Yeah, and we have a little bit of everything here. Right?
We do. We really do. And again, people think of Detroit, they think of it only in a kind of a singular way and sometimes in a negative way. That's not the case. And I think this is a great feather in our cap. And as if that's not enough, staying on the theme of how important art is, here's one for you. USA Today, again, another one of these rankings, ranks the DIA as the top art museum in the entire U.S.
I think that's the second time in a row for the Detroit Institute of Art, Jeff. Last year, it was also ranked by USA Today as the top museum.
Now, see, that really says something. What is that, one time's
it's fluke.
Luck?
Yeah, exactly. Beginner's luck.
Two times in a row to be.
I mean, it means something.
Yeah, I think it means something. Interestingly, when it comes to museums, and I do find this kind of amazing, I mean, there's some powerhouses on this list. Chicago comes in at number 10, just to benchmark this a bit. I mean, Chicago's got some of the greatest museums in the world, let alone in the country. And lastly, we are tooting our own horn a little bit here,
but those
of you driving around on a Saturday afternoon, here, you can feel good about where you live. You can do a little bragging, right? Mm-hmm. Here's a little bragging rights. We're not done yet. We got one more for you. Campus Martius in Detroit, nominated for best public square in the U.S.
That I can totally get behind. I agree with that 100%. They have the ice skating in the winter. They have the beach and the big movie screen in the summer. It's beautiful.
Great restaurants.
Yeah, great restaurants surrounding it. I love Campus Martius.
Something to be proud of.
It's walkable.
It's the site, of course, of the annual Christmas tree. You know, it's a classic kind of town square. That's what a town square is supposed to be, right?
It's a true public square. And it's the future home of the NFL draft.
Yes. By the way, I heard the other day it's going to be a little crowded when it comes to draft time down there, which is exactly what we want. We want that energy. That's what it's all about. All right. And with all of that, we've got some really important news. This has to do with the crisis that the global chocolate industry is facing these days. We've got a real problem on our hands, that's for sure. The price for cocoa, as the article which I caught in Morning Brew had to say, the chocolate industry has not seen a crisis like this since Johnny Depp played Willy Wonka. Demand for chocolate is, that's serious. Demand for chocolate is vastly outweighing the available cocoa supply, leading to skyrocketing cocoa prices.
Well, you know, Jeff, we talked about it around Halloween and about the price of sugar and how yes. Halloween candy was getting so expensive. But now it makes sense. Everything. It's all the things that are good are turning into being very expensive.
Well, see, now that would follow. Of course, markets are driven at the most fundamental level by supply and demand. Good things have demand. And then ultimately, demand outpaces supply. Prices go up. We've got a crisis on our hands. Mm-hmm. A big one.
So if anybody's noticing their Easter candy is a little more expensive this year, well, now you know why.
Listen, let's hope that the powers that be get this crisis under control soon. All right. Listen, we're going to run to a break. When we come back on Let's Go Michigan, Kristen, we've got some interesting ground to cover. Tell us what we've got coming up on the show.
Yeah, later on in the show, we're talking to Margaret Fleming, and she is going to enlighten us on sports betting, especially within college campuses.
Yeah, and especially this time of year, right, with the March Madness.
Yes, so we're going to get to the bottom of that and figure out what's happening. We're also going to speak with Kathleen Davis about the 32-hour work week. And then finally, Jennifer Streaks from Business Insider is going to give us some tips on how to avoid shrinkflation when we shop at the grocery store.
Okay, no shrinkflation when it comes to our chocolate bars. That would be crossing the line.
Yeah.
You know, every now and then in society and culture, there are major sea changes in the way we behave, maybe the way we buy things or the way we engage in various activities and things. And I'll tell you, one of those big sea changes emerged a few years ago now, and that is our love for betting on sports. That market, now valued at $83.65 billion in 2022, expected to grow to $91.43. Boy, it's big. Mark, I've got to ask you, you love sports, and part of the fun of sports is kind of picking which team is going to win. Now, it's one thing to jaw about it and have some fun with your friends. You pick, you think who's going to win. He or she picks who he or she thinks is going to win. That's part of the fun. It's another thing to put your money where your mouth is and put money down on it. Mark, I've got to ask you, and I do not know the answer to this. Do you bet on sports at all?
I just started with all
really?
These new apps. Yeah, it's great. The parlays, you pick how many points a guy's going to score. Maybe you pick how many steals. Who's going to win a coin toss? It's crazy.
It's crazy, isn't it? Well, so you just started. Are you playing, like, what's an average hand that you play on things?
Oh, it's not much. You just play $10 and pick the parlays. You could win $50, $60.
Sure.
I think the first time I did it,
sure.
I won $150. It was...
Okay, and a parlay, I don't bet on sports, but set me straight here. A parlay is where you are stringing together a series of things that happen in order for...
Right.
And if that happens, you win the bet, in effect.
Yeah, it could be three things, could be 15 things.
Right.
So your odds change as you add more to your parlay. And then sometimes you don't want to bet because it kind of ruins the game.
It can kind of make you a little miserable, can't it?
Yeah, you're trying to get all these parlays to hit, but your team wins the game and you're bummed out.
That exactly. Are you more interested in the team winning or making money? That's part of the challenge of this. We're going to be speaking with Margaret Fleming. She's a sports media fellow at businessinsider.com. She covers all things related to sports and in particular sports business. And boy, sports betting. You want to talk about change. You want to talk about change in business. You want to talk about change in sports and business. Here it is. Margaret Fleming, welcome to the show. Thanks. Tell us about what's going on in the wild world of sports betting. And in particular, as your article points out, how sports betting now has even infiltrated the college age enthusiast who's getting hooked on this idea. We all know the numbers. We hear the stories. Tell us about that.
Yeah, thank you all for having me. I'm excited to be here. We had heard about somebody who had sort of had some gambling problems in college, had to drop out of class, and we thought, is this something that other people have dealt with as well? So we reached out just very openly to some researchers and some college students and just said, hey, what is this experience like for you? What does sports betting look like for you? And we found it's so normalized. It's just the same as, you know, sharing a study guide, sharing a playlist, as I said in the article. But the researchers and the students are worried that they aren't being educated on all of these risks associated with problem gambling. And so many of these companies are targeting their marketing on social media or, you know, ways to keep users coming back. And so they're really kind of in this dangerous position when they're so young and it's so normal among their friends and among sports fans, but they haven't been taught all the risks.
Yeah. And when you think about gambling risks, you know, there's a telltale sign that gets missed by a lot of people, young or old, doesn't matter. And that is that if you take, for example, whether it's online or in a physical environment like a casino, whatever it may be, just remember one thing, those palaces out there in Las Vegas that have been built, don't get built because the house loses more than they win. In fact, to the contrary, the fact is when you gamble, you lose more than you win. And that's just something that gets missed because everyone thinks, I'm going to be good at this. And it's fun. And there's a certain experience associated with it. How many times has someone come back from Las Vegas and said, you know, spent some money, we lost some money, but we had a great time. It was just a good time. So we looked at it as though we were paying for the good time. But that gets missed a lot. And all of a sudden people wake up and their bank accounts have been drained.
I'm going to ask a question because I don't really know anything about gambling, sports gambling, college kids, younger kids that are betting on certain sports apps. Do you have to be 21?
Yeah, so it's interesting because it might not be labeled as sports betting, but there's still lots of ways to put money down on sports and sort of scratch that itch. And so daily fantasy sports is one way people do that. You can be 18 or up. Just like, you know, fantasy football or something like that, you have your team, you have your roster, and you're putting money down on your own players and how well they might perform. And there's also an app that we wrote about that's more of the sweepstakes style game. And that presents itself to the user. It looks like a sports book, but it's kind of like winning the lottery or something. There's sweepstakes games in there. And so since it's categorized as that, that's also available to 18 and up users. And these both daily fantasy and sweepstakes style games are oftentimes legal in states where sports betting is not legal. And so we spoke to students in states where sports betting has not been legalized yet. And they and their friends have used these daily fantasy games and these sweepstakes games to still feel that rush and put money down on sports. And then, of course, there's plenty of ways that have been around for years, like offshore apps or using like a bookie through the fraternity or something like that, that have kind of always been around. But just because sports betting has become so normal now, those are just as present, if not more than ever.
Yeah, it's interesting. You talk about avoiding the online gambling classification by offering a sweepstakes style experience. You can also offer a game of skill as opposed to a game of chance style experience. That also then makes it easier for these apps to proliferate. You don't have to register state by state. You don't have to worry about online gambling laws because you fall outside the gambling category. In fact, I think gambling roughly is defined as something where you're, you know, putting money up. You are getting a chance to win money at the back end. And in between, you're playing a game, whatever it may be, an experience of chance, based on chance, at least predominantly based on chance. Whereas a game of skill, you put the money up, you have a shot to win money at the back end of the experience, but there's a game of skill in between that you're playing, and that helps avoid the gambling classification as well. Nonetheless, to your point, and it's absolutely true, whether it's classified as gambling or not, in sweepstakes, for example, buying a lottery ticket, there are ways to lose money, and in fact, there's likelihood to lose money. Only one or a handful of people win the big prize at the other end. Millions and millions put the money up to build the pot, but they all lose their money in the process. And again, a lot of this gets lost, and people just look the other way, or they look at it as a way to invest in having an enjoyable experience.
Right, and it's not even that so many people are losing so much, but over time, you're putting down small amounts of money and developing these habits that because it's something you do with all your friends, you're routinely putting down $10, $15, or even smaller amounts than that. It just becomes such a normal part that it's become a lot easier. I mean, these researchers we spoke to said that 5 years ago, everyone in their clinic was in their 40s and their 50s. And now everyone in their clinic coming for treatment for their addiction is much, much younger than that, you know? And so these trends since sports betting has become a state-by-state issue back since 2018, the researchers are seeing that, yes, more of them are having these severe cases, like more extreme cases of developing an addiction, but just a lot of them are, you know, these smaller increments, these smaller amounts building these habits. And again, like we said before, not necessarily being taught by anybody how to make sure that those habits don't become more extreme.
Well, it's become a social part of college life. It's so normal now. it's part of the culture. It's a way to stay connected because you are either trading money to have somebody bet for you, or you're consulting with your group of friends on what to bet on.
Or you're doing the whole smack talk thing, like, or, you know, yeah, who did you yes. pick? Could you pick? Yeah. How could you get that wrong? Right. You know, whatever.
Yeah, many of the students told us exactly that. Like, it's such a thing with their friends. They thought that to have friends, you have to be willing to put money down on sports betting. And even if they decided not to put money down anymore, they're still discussing it constantly with their friends and the podcast they're hearing. It's such a part of your world if you're a sports fan. And so it absolutely makes sense for many of these young men that just love sports, that it's just become such a social thing.
Yeah, based on your research in preparation to author the article, let me ask you, what do you think's ahead? Do you see more loosening of regulation, more proliferation of this type of activity? Or do you see, as a result of some of the stories emerging now and some of the issues that people have, either online gambling or facsimiles of it that may not technically qualify as online gambling, because as we've just illustrated, whether it's sweepstakes or some other form of activity like this where you can lose money, do you see that tightening maybe from a regulatory standpoint, or what do you think's ahead?
It's hard to say. I do think it's become such a massive part of sports culture now that I think betting in some form is not going away anytime soon. But I think a lot of states are realizing some of these daily fantasy or some of these sweepstakes games are a little bit more looking like sports betting than they are looking like not sports betting, I guess.
So
I could see, whether it's state by state or larger than that, maybe some kind of additional regulation of those. But again, because it is so fragmented right now and such a state by state issue, I think it's going to be interesting to see how it kind of unfolds here. It's hard to predict because it feels like it's been around for a long time because it's such a big deal now, but it really has only been a handful of years.
Well, in other states, less than that.
Right. So I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, especially for that 18 to 21 demographic, what states decide to do with that.
All right, Margaret Fleming, sports media fellow, businessinsider.com. Thank you so much, Margaret, for giving us guidance on what's going on in sports betting, and in particular, how even now college-age students make it part of their experience, their life experience. It's infiltrated their culture and that level of demographic society, to be sure. Listen, now we're going to focus on earning our money. Of course, we earn our money, most of us anyway, by working and working and working. Working a lot.
And working a lot.
Working more than ever these days to be able to pay the bills and have some spending money on the side. Kristen, you're going to bring us another interview in this segment that you were able to do on the subject of the subject that just doesn't go away. It's kind of always there, and it's really gaining popularity, gaining a lot of support, starting to be actually implemented by many companies and, frankly, demanded by many of the workforce at various other companies. And that's the 4-day work week. Work 4 days, have a 3-day weekend, right? Just the idea is you got to have the same amount of productivity packed into 4 days, work harder, maybe even work longer during those 4 days, and you get a 3-day weekend, all right? That's the trade-off. But there's a new model afoot that's gaining popularity, and that is, instead of looking at it as a 4-day work week, looking at it by the hour, in effect, in this case, a 32-hour work week as opposed to a 40-hour work week. It's kind of the equivalent, but one day could have more hours than another. You break the hours up however you want to do it. Could even be 5 days. Just put in less hours across those 5 days. It's kind of an interesting idea, Kristen.
I agree. I had a great conversation with Kathleen Davis. She's the deputy editor of Fast Company, and she's also host of the Way We Work podcast that we implement 32 hours of working and spread it over 5 days, and the benefits that it could have to not only working moms, but industries across the board.
All right, guys, I can hear it. It's our Monday morning conversation. Are we going to a 32-hour week?
Oh, my pitch deck's ready for you.
We do 32-hour days.
Yeah, we do, don't we, Mark? We certainly do. All right, so let's hear your interview with Kathleen, Kristen.
So let's start by just giving our listeners an overview of what the difference is between a 32-hour work week versus a 4-day work week. I feel like that's all we've heard recently is pushing this 4-day work week. They've done tests, studies, research about the 4-day work week. And then your article popped up about the 32-hour work week. And it actually made me stop and think, well, now that's a smart idea. Why didn't anybody promote that? So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the difference is and some of the pros and cons of both?
Yeah, well, I mean, to be clear, smart companies who are doing a 4-day work week are doing a 32-hour 4-day work week. So they're not trying to cram 40 hours into 4 days. hopefully, you know, again, if you're a smart company, you figured out that that's just a recipe for burnout and kind of negates the benefits of having an extra day off. But you're right. The 4-day work week has gotten a lot of attention in the last year, especially. There was, I think you alluded to it, there was a big 4-day work week pilot program with 70 companies and over 3,000 workers in the UK. It's really been used as kind of a recruiting tool, especially during the Great Resignation. And who doesn't love a 3-day weekend? I am here to say I am not anti 3-day
weekend. Yeah.
You know, and like in a perfect world, I think we would reduce the working hours and have a 3-day weekend. But what I am putting forth is that, and what really kind of caught my eye and started me thinking about it even more, was that it was in the United Auto Workers' initial bargaining agreement was a 32-hour work week. And I think they didn't get it. They, you know, left that off the table.
Right.
And I don't know if they specified, you know, exactly the hours. But my thinking is that a 4-day work week is a kind of a hard sell, right? It's kind of a hard sell to companies. It raises a lot of questions like, what are you going to do with your customer service on that day off? Like that sort of thing.
That's exactly what I was just going to ask. If you're only working 4 days a week, what happens that other typical work day? What happens to customer service and shipping and all the rest of the stuff that goes into just that one specific work day? If it's shut down, how do you balance that throughout the rest of the 4 days?
Yeah, exactly. And I point out in the article that I wrote that we've made these kind of big logistical shifts before. The concept of a weekend is something that didn't exist 100 years ago that was given to us. Actually, Ford started it with his factory workers, and then it caught on with the Fair Labor Standards Act in the 1930s that made the 40-hour work week, made the 5-day work week and the weekend. But you're right. It's kind of a big hurdle to get over. It's a lot of logistical challenge with customer service. Like, our doctor's office is only going to be
right.
open.
Yeah.
4 days, you know, those sorts of things. I think we can get there, and I think we probably should get there. But I think a 32-hour work week, 5 days a week, is an incremental but really significant change that will be a lot easier for employers to do and really makes a lot of sense for a lot of reasons.
Well, as a full-time working mom, a 32-hour work week seems amazing to me because I could pick up my kids from school.
Yep.
I don't have to pay as much in daycare afterwards. I mean, to me, it's a win-win. But again,
yeah.
I'm looking at it as a full-time working mom.
Same. I'm in the exact same boat. And I think any parent who hears that is like, yes, sign me up 100%. And it really is a 40-hour, a 9-to-5, like it didn't come down on high from like a scientific study. It was just the way that like factories functioned the best 200 years ago. There's no reason that we should be working 9-to-5. And yes, the most obvious benefit schedule-wise is for working parents. That, you know, the misalignment between the typical school day, which usually ends between 2 and 4, and the typical work day, which ends between 5 and 6.
That's right. You know,
70% of working parents don't end until 2 hours after their kids are out of school. We're in a childcare crisis post-pandemic. Mm-hmm. We were in a childcare crisis before, but it's even worse now. You know, that childcare gap, it's gotten worse. It's more expensive. But again, and I always say this, you know, like with things like paid leave, when you'll hear employees go, well, I don't have kids. Why should I care about that? Everybody would benefit from having more hours of free time in their day for their mental and physical health. Employees are less productive. Some studies have said employees are productive for less than 60% of the day.
That is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like 2 hours. One study found 2 hours and 23 minutes a day is how much you're being productive. So the other 5 hours, you're just like stuck in pointless meetings. I mean, who does not have a meeting that could have been an email? Get that hour back and, you know, improve your life.
Right. If the research shows we're really only productive 2 hours and 23 minutes each day, well, then why not go to the 32 hours a week? If I was the boss, I would say, great. I'd want the most productivity out of my employees. Mm-hmm. And if I can get that done in a shorter period of time across all 5 days, go, let's do it.
Yeah. And it's such an old school of management thought to like value FaceTime and butts in seats and like how long you're sitting there. And don't you want your employees doing valuable work rather than like filling the hours and being unhappy about it? I think the other kind of elephant in the room about it, and the reason why UAW, I think, put it in their initial bargaining agreement, was the idea that AI and automation and technology is supposed to free us up to have less work to do and more time. I mean, that's the whole promise of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so the idea, and you know, maybe some listeners have heard of the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, who's in 1930 predicted that by 2030, so in a couple of years, we would only be working 15 hours a week. Now, that prediction is way off base for a lot of reasons, and human ambition, you know, being chief among them, that we're not talking about a 15-hour work week. But the belief that automation is supposed to make our lives easier, is supposed to make our work less tedious, it's supposed to free us up from those kind of tedious tasks and use us for the things that humans are best at, you know, creative thinking and those sorts of things. So that's why, yes, I think the 32-hour work week is where we should be headed now. It's the easier sell, but eventually maybe both, maybe both, maybe 4 days and 6-hour work days, or right, even less.
And are there companies now that have put into place this 32-hour work week?
You know, most of the companies that we have been covering and hearing from have been talking about the 4-day work week, which again is 32 hours, you know, is 8-hour days, only 4 days a week. But a lot of companies too are, especially with remote work, and have realized that you don't really have to care so much when work is getting done, so much that it's getting done. I think in general, you know, more flexibility around when work is getting done is definitely the way that a lot of employers are starting to think about things. It's the way that Gen Z just assumes that work will happen. It is obviously a, you know, a big recruiting tool for companies as well.
Right. As we continue to navigate these new uncharted waters with remote work and the idea of the 4-day work week, 32-hour work weeks, it's almost like we're starting fresh with new ideas on how we need to live our best lives. So it's definitely something to look into. So I appreciate it, Kathleen. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you.
All right. Well, listen, I think I'm buying into the idea that working fewer hours could indeed maybe help with team morale, productivity even perhaps, and all the rest. So here's what I'm willing to do. I don't know about 32 hours.
Okay.
But I'm willing to go maybe down to 48 hours per week. That's about as low as we're going to go here.
All right. Well.
But I do buy into the idea that reducing the weekly workload, the hours that you have to put in, may make some sense. Like, you got me that far.
Okay, I'll make some adjustments
there
to my pitch to
there
you.
There we
okay.
go. All right, progress, progress. Listen, we were kind of joking around at the beginning of the show, talking about the subject matter, shrinkflation. We mentioned we don't want that happening to our chocolate bars. We certainly don't, but it goes way beyond just our chocolate bars and the impact that shrinkflation can have on downsizing. That's really what shrinkflation is, right?
Yep.
You keep the price point the same, but you shrink the volume of food you deliver, thereby shrinking the cost to the producer, and that creates that level of margin, or even worse, and this is where it really crosses the line, but where it really gets kind of ugly is where they downsize the amount of product they give you, keep the price the same, or increase the price perhaps due to what they call inflation. What they're doing is increasing their margin at our cost when that really didn't need to happen. They're really kind of taking advantage of us at that point. And so, Kristen, you found a story that I'm glad you brought to us. It's a good one and an appropriate one, one we all need to be aware of. Caveat emptor, buyer beware. Make sure when you go into the store, you're not just price checking, but you're also checking price checking against the volume of product that you're buying to make sure you're not going to be a victim of this horrible shrinkflation phenomenon that's going on out there in the retail world today. Well, the story you found is written by Jennifer Streaks. She's a senior personal finance reporter at Business Insider, and we've got her here with us right now. Jennifer, welcome. At a high level, tell us about shrinkflation, what it is, and how it's impacting consumers today.
Yeah, definitely. We know that grocery prices are high. They've stayed consistently high, even though they may be coming down in some areas. Where shrinkflation is playing a part is that you have manufacturers and companies that see that consumers aren't going to take it anymore in terms of raising prices. So what they're going to do is repackage everyday items, make it smaller, but leave the same price. So you're basically paying the same amount for less, which is costing you more money because, of course, you go through the product faster. You're not getting as much, you're back at the store buying it again. And so it's a sneaky way to still increase prices without looking like you're increasing prices.
So let me ask you, I'm curious about this. I mean, we're familiar with that, you know, and a lot of people really do pinch pennies, manage their purchasing very carefully and tightly, and they know the price of a particular potato chip brand bag and the size brand they typically buy, and they know what they pay for it. So it's kind of routine. But the tricky part here is that it's not like there's a big sign marking the fact that, oh, beware, you know, this is the price, but the amount you're getting is less. That burden falls on the consumer, right? And that can be very tricky for us.
Right, because most consumers, when you're at the grocery store, you're not looking at ounces. You're
exactly.
not looking at how many pounds something is. You're literally looking at the size.
That's a strong point, Kristen. And for me, for example, I know when you go through the grocery store, I have found, I use the example of potato chips. My boy wanted potato chips the other day. I got them for him and took it home, and the bag was smaller.
Yeah.
But you didn't really notice it. It's not like it goes half size
right.
or quarter size. We're talking about subtle 20% decrease, or maybe the bag even stays the same, but there's less volume of food in it, right?
Correct. And the thing is, like you said, you're not looking at ounces. Sometimes you're not looking at anything because you're grabbing what you always grab.
Exactly.
So that's why the manufacturer knows that they can just change the bag and change how it looks or come up with a snappy new slogan. And that's why it's on the consumer to check and say, you know, is this the same size? Am I still getting the same value? You know, my dad went grocery shopping and he said, oh, you know, it felt different in my hand. I could tell that it was lighter, even if it's something like that. But you have to definitely be on the lookout to make sure that you are not a victim of shrinkflation.
Right. And of course, when you say it feels lighter, you don't really have an A-B comparison. You don't have the old bag to compare it to. So you're really guessing. I know you've got some great tips you published in the article in Business Insider. And we want to run through that list in a second. But I have to ask you, you use the term that these brands can be sneaky and get away with this, and it's a way for them to make more money. Now, it's one thing if the brand had to do this because costs have gone up and people stop buying their product if they have to raise the price. So what they do is they make it in a smaller bag. They keep the price relatively the same. The question is that sneaky or is that smart business on their part? And that's just the way business is. There's got to be margin for these brands. Otherwise, the product won't be for very much longer on the store shelves because the producer's not making a margin on it. Is it sneaky or isn't it?
Well, then, if that's the case, if you're saying this is a business decision, this is influenced by inflation, then why not say that?
But where do you say that?
You can say it on the bag. You can tweet about it. I mean, there are products that are in my home that I've bought for years, for years, for years. And I think that anytime you have an opportunity to be honest, that's going to be better received than not.
I do agree with that, actually. I mean, if my Tide laundry soap, for example, started running ads on social media that said, hey, you know what? Times are tough for us, too. And these are the changes that we're going to make. I'd actually respect that more. And I'd probably continue to stay loyal to them because I knew ahead of time, like, yeah, they're cutting costs. They're going to either decrease the size of the soap or increase the price. I feel like transparency is important.
I totally agree.
There's that issue. And that transparency helps solve that issue. And that issue being, should you inform consumers and make them aware of the fact you're going to get less of this product for the same price you've paid historically or something like that. But there's also an issue of, I know I've read, there are some brands, they're just taking advantage of the opportunity to do this because it's being done. And frankly, it's not an issue of trying to keep my margins. It's simply a matter of we can make more money by doing this. And that's really ugly.
That's right. And that's exactly why I wrote the article, because if you have an opportunity to be transparent, we're with you. Everyone is having a bit of a hard time now due to the economy and lingering inflation. Anyone can understand that. But when you just say, oh, this is an opportunity for us just to make more money, then, you know, that's when it's negative. That's when you're not considering the consumer.
Yeah, indeed. So you do have some tips that you published in your article. Tell us how you can protect yourself from being surprised and being taken advantage of in certain cases.
So when you are grocery shopping, this is the time to look around. I understand that sometimes we are comforted by the familiar and you go to your brand, you go to that area in the store every time you get there. But this is the time to pay attention and check and see, has there been some sort of change to the packaging? Does it look smaller? Check for alternatives to your favorite brand. Maybe, you know, if something has gotten smaller in size, but the price hasn't changed, it might be time to, you know, switch brands, especially if you see that the package has been downsized quite a bit. I mean, 20% for the same price is kind of a shock. Mm-hmm. I would also suggest buying store brands. They are going to fall to shrinkflation last because they're already less expensive. If you think about Kirkland at Costco or store brands at Walmart or CVS, think about shopping at stores like Costco or BJ's, where you can buy even larger sized items that will last longer. And I already said this, but pay attention to the packaging. Don't just get caught up in buying the same thing over and over and over again. If you see that something looks like it has changed, it probably has. The manufacturer isn't going to tell you this. They might even put it out there and say it's new and improved to go along with the change in packaging. But also that means that they probably have shrunk the size.
Yeah. And here's a really good tip that you give. And I know I've used this actually in price comparing. And that is this. You say keep track of unit pricing. This is where you distill it down so that you can do that A-B comparison where you're pricing it, say, for example, an 8-ounce jar of something. You've got a price per ounce and you're comparing it to a 6-ounce jar. But, you know, again, you're able to do that price comparison based on an apples-to-apples type comparison by comparing ounce to ounce, for example.
Costco does a good job of that. And they put it right on the label, plain as day, so that you can see where I feel like at typical grocery stores, it's all in the fine print.
Sure. And that's a really, that's a great tip.
Correct. I think that's totally right. It's right there on the shelf. And so if you're used to buying a 30-ounce jar of anything and it costs $8, but now you look and you see that it's down to 20 ounces or 23 ounces. And you're like, huh, this is not the same value that I'm expecting. This isn't the same size. It's not the same amount, but the price is the same. You know that something has changed and not in your favor.
Interesting. Well, this is great. Eye-opening and
Good, very informative.
Great tips. Great job. Jennifer Streaks, Senior Personal Finance Reporter, Business Insider. Thanks so much for being with us and for bringing us the story, Jennifer.
Definitely. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. I just have to ask, have you guys gone into a store and actually, like, you're busted? I see that you're selling this product to me at the same price, but there's actually less product in it. Have you discovered that?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you remember what it was?
It's the potato chips.
Potato chips, right?
It is. Right. It's such an obvious one. And also cereal.
Cereal, big time. Right? Wow. The box is the same height. So when you look at it, it looks like the one you bought last week. If you pull it out, it looks like a pad of paper.
That's tricky. That's not fair.
And it says family size.
Yeah, right. What does that mean?
Family of one.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, there we go. Hey, listen, this is a great show. Lots of good information. Lots of information that was fun to bring to you all. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. You guys go out and make it a great weekend. Kristen, Mark, great being with you on the show. We'll be back right here, same place, same time, with Let's Go Michigan right here on WJR.